from AI and deep learning to cybersecurity and IoT, keeping up with technology can be challenging.
Our podcast is not just about helping you keep up. We're inviting you to the precipice of what we now know is possible.
Join us as we interview industry luminaries and trailblazers to hear how they're leveraging technology, navigating the pitfalls, and predicting the future.
Together, we'll explore today's most timely topics, combining human imagination and intelligent technologies to discover new solutions.
I am happy to introduce my co-host, Mr. James Marcella, security expert and industry association leader.
And it's a pleasure to introduce Scott Dunn, technology innovator and award-winning speaker.
And this is Connect, a podcast from Axis Communications. Well, welcome everybody to today's Axis Connect podcast. I'm your host, Scott Dunn. And today we'll be talking a little bit more about cybersecurity. We're very fortunate to have an esteemed guest, Steve Zaromski, Vice President of Information Technology and CIO at Bridgewater State University here in beautiful Massachusetts. Welcome, Steve.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Well, we are excited to get into this, and I want to thank you for taking the time to join us. I'd like to get going just sort of for starters. You have a very interesting background and story about how you got to this current position. If you could just give us a couple of minutes on your sort of how you became the cybersecurity guru at Bridgewater State, I would love to hear that.
Sure. Happy to give you a background. And you know what? Why don't I even start with just giving you a little bit of background about Bridgewater State University? So real quick, you know, we are a four-year liberal arts institution in Bridgewater, Massachusetts. So we have just under 10,000 students at Bridgewater State. And what a lot of people don't know is we are actually the 10th largest four-year institution, college or university, public or private, in Massachusetts. So we're a decent size. We've been around since 1840, so we kind of know what we're doing now, you know? So I would say as far as my journey here, I've been at Bridgewater State for, actually, my anniversary is in June. This is my 20th year, so it's been quite a ride. I actually started, believe it or not, as a student here, fell in love with the institution, and I started working as a student employee with an IT. I left for a very short period of time, but then a position opened up with an IT in, I guess I'll call it end user support, right? Desktop support back in the day. And I applied and I got the position. And again, I just really loved, I loved being a student at Bridgewater, but I also really loved being an employee. Obviously that shows after almost 20 years, but started in end user support. And then I ended up pivoting over into networking, network engineering, administration. And that's kind of where, if anyone asks me, like, where do you go back to as far as your roots in IT? I kind of look at networking as kind of like my roots. I was doing that for a long time. And then I realized, you know what? I really wanted to get into the management role and the leadership roles. And I became a director. Then I became an AVP. And going on almost 5 years ago, our CIO at the time said, "Hey, Steve, I'm leaving." And I just remember thinking to myself, oh man, could you just give me another couple more years and I'll be ready, which you're never ready, right? So I ended up moving into the role, and that was, you know, maybe about 6 months or so right before the pandemic, and then kaboom, the wheels fell off, and talk about getting put to the test. So, you know, it's been almost 5 years now, and it's been quite a ride, and I'm really, really enjoying it here.
Well, it sounds like you've been there since 1840 from what I'm hearing there. So it's, you look really good for your age. Yes, you do. So considering the fact that you've really worked at pretty much all levels of IT within this university, I'm curious about what are some of the biggest needs and challenges of educational institutions when it comes to technology today? I mean, what are you looking at?
Well, you know, I like to start with our mission. And, you know, our mission within IT is to enable and advance the success of students, faculty, staff, and all related constituent groups. That's our mission. And our vision in IT, that our shared vision that we established, is really centered around service excellence, right? And so we strive to provide high quality service to everyone that we serve. So the challenge with that, though, comes because, well, like you said, we are a very large institution, and it's very difficult to please everybody. So, you know, I would say one of the challenges that we face is you're getting hit with demands from multiple different colleges, multiple different departments, and having to be able to collaborate with them in the way that we want to and provide that high quality service always is challenging, but we're fortunate enough that we're able to do that. Now, we are centralized within IT here at Bridgewater State, which I think is a huge benefit for us in that we are able to establish those relationships across the institution and have those really strong stakeholder engagements and provide a really good, robust portfolio of technology to our faculty, staff, and students. But, you know, staffing is always a challenge. You know, I mentioned we are the 10th largest school in Massachusetts, but we also are a public institution and we have to live within our means. You know, we can't just be hiring as many people as we like to do. So that's always a bit of a challenge for us. I would say, you know, talking about cyber security in particular, protecting the campus is always a challenge, right? We're a target. Like, that's just the nature of, we all are. It doesn't matter your industry, your sector, your vertical. It doesn't matter. Everyone is a target, and public, in higher education in particular, is a prime target, just given the nature of what we do and the openness of our campus. So, you know, the continuous oversight and investments and, you know, that we need to put into cybersecurity to protect our students, our faculty, our staff, and our data is always a challenge and always will be a challenge.
And I think about, you mentioned 10,000 students. That's 10,000 people bringing what, on average, 2 to 3 devices of their own into your networks on a daily basis, say 20 to 30,000 devices that come on from outside your network, right? That's going to be pretty challenging as an IT professional.
Absolutely. And that, yes, that's students, but we serve the region, right? We are a focal point within Massachusetts. We have lots of visitors that come to campus that aren't affiliated with the institution, right? Guests, parents, conferences, you know, faculty, staff who also have their own devices. So yes, it's a huge surface that we need to protect. And it's something that's always top of mind for sure.
So when I looked at this upcoming podcast, I was really interested in this latest big news you've had at Bridgewater State, which was the launch of your cybersecurity program. What were the main sort of catalysts for starting this program? And what does it really take to build such a cutting-edge bachelor program for cybersecurity?
Yeah, well, I appreciate the question. This is really big news for Bridgewater State and really, we think, for Massachusetts and beyond. So we have a brand new bachelor's degree in cybersecurity and digital forensics. What's different about this degree compared to, say, other cybersecurity degrees that may be out there is Bridgewater State is the first 4-year public university in Massachusetts to have a fully accredited degree in cybersecurity, right? So we're not offering a bachelor's in computer science with a concentration, let's say, in cyber, where you take a couple of classes. This is a full-blown cybersecurity 4-year degree. It's a technical degree, and it's accredited, right? So it's gone through the paces, so to speak. It's had external reviewers, it's had internal reviewers, and it's basically been put through the test to be a very high-quality degree program in cyber. So we're very proud of that. We also have a master's degree in cybersecurity that's coming down the pipeline. And we also have non-degree bearing certificate programs that we're working on as well. To answer your question on really the why, and it comes down to demand. There is a huge, as I know you know, Scott, there is a huge demand for cybersecurity professionals, right? It's just in the recent numbers alone, nationally, we're looking at around 600,000 jobs. It's huge.
Yeah.
And it was even higher than that, actually, not that long ago.
Wow.
So it's huge, huge demand, not only just locally here in Mass, but nationally as well. You know, this is a national priority. It's been set forth by the White House, and it's really a global crisis overall, if you will. So there's a huge demand, and we feel that we're in a position to help you know, help meet that demand. That's one reason. I would say the second reason that we launched this is accessibility. And what I mean by that is 48% of our students in particular are first generation students, right? Parents have never gone to college before. And so they come to Bridgewater State looking for opportunity. So that's another reason. And I would say the third reason, the last reason I'll mention is the cybersecurity industry overall is pretty much dominated by white males, right? There's lack of diversity in cybersecurity overall. And just given our unique position, I mean, a third of our students are students of color, right? And so when you think about opportunity and how you have almost half of our students are first gen, a third are students of color, we're really creating opportunities for students to enroll in programs and help diversify the workforce that they otherwise thought they might not be able to do.
Well, those sound like three excellent reasons why there's definitely a need here. I love the diversity point of expanding that. You're right. I think of cybersecurity people as these guys with their hoodies on, and they're in their at their computers, and they're just hacking away. And but I'm curious. I mean, what kind of background might I need to get into this program, and what are the objectives and sort of unique features? And do you create a real world experience for these students as they come into the program? What can they kind of expect?
Sure. So to answer that, everyone has an opportunity in cyber. That's what I would like to say. I think a lot of people think of, oh, I can't do that, or it's too technical, or it's too hard, or I don't have I want to demystify that myth right now, that is just simply not true. There is an opportunity for you, whether you are a technical person or a non-technical person, there is opportunity in cyber. Right. So, yes, obviously, there's the traditional technical path of being, say, a SOC, which, you know, that's the acronym for Security Operations Center, a SOC analyst. Right. Those are the people that are, you know, sitting and looking for actual cybersecurity threats within an organization. If they see something suspicious, that's when they kind of step in and start to identify and detect and respond to the potential threat, right? That's a typical SOC analyst role. But there's so many other areas that people can go down, even outside of the technical role. You could get into training, right? There's a huge demand for training in cybersecurity that doesn't necessarily require someone to have, you know, the real hands on the keyboard, really deep, 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 you know, I'm talking knowledge about cybersecurity and how networks operate and all that. You can still have a very strong career in cybersecurity training alone. Documentation, the risk really goes on, Scott, about what people can do. And I think if people just start to talk with us and start to learn and speak with our faculty and just educate themselves on the opportunities that are out there, they're really going to see, like, you know what, I do have a place here in cyber. So that's the one thing that I would really want to demystify. To talk a little bit more about the program, though, and what they can expect, you know, it's a technical degree. So, yes, you're going to learn, learn a lot about networks. You're going to learn about operating systems. You're going to learn about, obviously, all the different cybersecurity tools that are out there and the forensics aspect. But I think the real important thing that I want to mention here about what you can expect is it's really a unique and different approach to cybersecurity training that we offer at Bridgewater. And what I mean by that is it's three-pronged, right? So one, we have the degree program, which I talked about. But two, which you started to lean into, is we just opened up our cyber range, right? And a cyber range, for those who might not understand what that is a facility. It's a quite a beautiful facility that we're able to build. Provides people with the ability to experience real lifelike cybersecurity events, such as, say, ransomware, right? But in a safe virtualized environment. So I like to look at it this way. When a pilot goes to fly a plane, or if someone wants to become a pilot, you don't just go into the classroom alone, right? And learn the theoretical, like, all right, I push these buttons and up I go, right? You actually have to experience flying in a flight simulator before you get into the cockpit. Well, that's what we're doing with cyber. So we teach you the theoretical knowledge and the principles and the practices in the classroom, but then we apply that knowledge in the cyber range. And we present you with real, again, real life, like we call them live fire exercises. that mimic incidents that actually occurred in the wild. So you get to work on industry tools such as, I'm going to throw out some technical terms here, but, you know, Palo Alto firewalls, right? Or Cisco routers and switches, you know, Carbon Black, Splunk, right? So those are some industry tools that we as IT professionals use in the cyber world. You get to actually log into those and experience that before you graduate. And that's very unique. And so through the Cyber Range, we can, again, provide students with that hands-on practical experience before they go out and they get a job.
You know, I've visited Microsoft's Cyber Defense Center a couple of times. And when I saw the video of your Cyber Range, it reminded me of that Cyber Defense Center I saw where you've got the red and the different colors when they're under threat. It kind of reminded me of that, and it really looked very cool and very sort of real world to me. So I could imagine where the students would really appreciate that kind of experience. And I hope my pilots have been trained on simulators as well, because I never want to be on a plane where it's his first time and says, hey, this is really cool. I'd like to get behind that wheel. So cyber attack, data breaches, cybercrime simulations are all possible here. So is this part of the curriculum for them? Do they do sort of prep work and then you put them into the range? How does all of that work? Or is it just kind of, hey, you're working one day and boom, here's a ransomware attack, deal with it. How do you sort of structure all that?
Yeah, you're right on in that. It's something that you have to lead up to, right? We just don't expect anyone to kind of come out and just know how to plop down at the console and start defending against a ransomware incident, right? There's a lot of training and preparation that leads up to this. And so, you know, that's what students are going to get exposed to at our institution. Everything that we teach our students leads them to get prepared to work in the industry, right? Nice. And so they're going to get the exposure in the classroom. They're going to get that knowledge. Then through the range, that's when they start to get exposed to the various types of threats and incidents and how to work an incident, and then lead up into an actual live fire scenario. One of the other things that we can do within the range, which is lends itself perfectly to your question, is we have the ability to provide students with what we call labs, cyber labs within our range. And what that does, look at those as training materials. So if a student wants to focus on a particular area, let's say it's networking fundamentals, or maybe it's Linux basics, or Windows Server basics, or, you know, encryption, that sort of thing, they can go either during class or outside of class, they can log into the range and take these self-paced labs to help prepare them to get to a level of competency where they feel comfortable with sitting down in the range and actually going through a live fire scenario. The other thing that we can do with the range, which is important to note, is we can support people in person, but we can also support you remotely at the same time. So it's full, what we call high flex or flexible hybrid, where you could have a group of students in the room going through a scenario, right? Say it's a ransomware incident, but we could also have another group of people fully remote, but participating live at the same time. We're all talking just like we are right now. We can collaborate. We can see those cameras throughout the room. And it really mimics what we think in the industry people experience when they're going through it. Because obviously can mimic a national organization that perhaps has a footprint throughout the United States that is going through a cyber incident. Well, how do we all work together through this, right? So that's what we wanted to be able to provide to students.
So it's a great collaborative environment that you've built, and this experiential learning is so important. But I also understand that the Cyber Range and the SOC provide technical support to some local businesses, some municipalities through some kind of partnership with something called CyberTrust Massachusetts. What is that? What is that all about?
Great question. So I'll first start with talking about CyberTrust, and I'm going to elaborate a little bit more on the SOC. So CyberTrust Massachusetts is a nonprofit consortium. They were formed about a year and a half or so ago. And really their mission is to grow the cyber talent pipeline in Massachusetts, diversify the workforce. And they do so. So Bridgewater State is an inaugural, you know, a founding member of CyberTrust Massachusetts. We also, there's several other schools in the Commonwealth that are members of CyberTrust as well. Springfield Technical Community College, Mass Bay Community College, and recently Salem State has joined up as well. But what we're doing here is, it comes down to providing a unique and really innovative approach to cybersecurity training. So this is where I go into the SOC. So Bridgewater State, in addition to the range, also has a Security Operations Center, or SOC. And while the cyber range is virtual, you know, we're not dealing with actual live incidents here, right? It's a training ground. The SOC is real, right? And what Bridgewater State is doing in direct partnership with CyberTrust Massachusetts is we are going to stand up a physical SOC that provides live monitoring and detection services to municipalities and nonprofits in the area, right? Municipalities and nonprofits tend to be very target rich and cyber poor, right? So they tend to have, they have lots of sensitive information, but unfortunately, you know, a lot of these cities and towns are lucky if they have one person in IT focusing, just in IT in general. And if they have someone in cyber, well, that's really an anomaly, right? And so there's desperate help that is needed. And it's a win-win for both, if you think about it. Bridgewater State is able to provide these monitoring and detection services to these much-needed areas. And what we're going to do is have our students work in the SOC. So let's think about that now. You got high quality education, then you move over into the range where you can apply hands-on experience, right, and learn in a safe virtualized environment. Then you get to work in the Security Operations Center where you're dealing with live incidents all before you graduate. That's the unique recipe at Bridge that we're offering here, and that we've seen really, again, unique across the state and beyond.
What a fantastic way to sort of build them and get them ready to go out into the world and be cybersecurity experts. That's a great, great concept. You know, we were talking earlier just briefly about the shortages in the workforce for these types of jobs. And I'm curious, what can private industry, tech companies such as ourselves here at Axis Communications, what can we do to help support these programs in, you know, the cybersecurity initiatives as a whole? Is there anything we can be doing?
Well, I would say one of the things that you can do is partner with organizations like CyberTrust Massachusetts, right? So you can be, you can be a college or a university and you can join CyberTrust. But what CyberTrust is also doing is they're recruiting membership from private business, right? And what that allows is, one, it's a voice at the table. So it allows private industry to come in and say, hey, what is it that you want to see from our graduates, right? What is it in particular? What are the unique skill sets that you're looking for? How can we make sure that our programming, you know, across all of our member institutions is relevant, right? We want to meet workforce needs and workforce demand. So that's one benefit. But the other benefit of joining, say, CyberTrust is the fact that you get access to a large, diverse pipeline of, like we just talked about, experienced cyber students, right? And so I think industry needs to be at the table. Industry needs to continue to partner with higher education to provide access and opportunities to students, but also to share their input into how we need to be crafting the curriculum to meet the demands of the workforce.
That's great to know. And what I really want to do, and I've been a little remiss in that I haven't sort of set a primer up here for the uninitiated, but for those of them outside of your industry, just a couple of sort of basic questions or explanations. What's the difference between a cyber vulnerability and a cyber threat? Because we throw those terms around, at least in our industry, quite a bit, and the physical security side. What do you think? What are the differences there? Help me out.
Sure. So as far as a cyber vulnerability goes, a vulnerability is a flaw. It's a weakness. It's hopefully unintentional. Hence why security by design is a very important concept that we've been trying to drill home for 20, 30 years, but we're still beating that drum. But anyway, a threat is, you know, I think a lot of people think about the bad actors, which is very true. You know, your hackers out there that are trying to who are trying to basically exploit the vulnerability, right? So, you know, people may not know the vulnerabilities exist, but then you have threat is an example of where you have an outside individual that's basically trying to break in, exploit a vulnerability in your infrastructure for some sort of benefit. And usually 99.9% of the time, it's always financial, right? It's about the money. But there are, you know, there are other types of threats as well. So an unintentional threat, such as human error, right? You talked about an accidental backdoor. Mm-hmm. That misconfigurations happen all the time, right? So that's a huge threat. And then, of course, there's natural threats as well. Not necessarily always associated with cybersecurity, but certainly has the potential to damage our assets. And we have a role to protect the integrity and the availability of our data. And so I think, you know, natural threats or non-technical threats sometimes often go unthought of or unnoticed, and it needs to be part of the overall portfolio of protection.
And that's a great sort of comment that I want to follow up on, because you're talking about these threats and vulnerabilities. What do you see are the top three things every organization should do to try to bolster their cybersecurity profile? You know, what are the top three things they should be doing? Best practices. You know, is there a top three, or are there 23 things you have to do?
I'd say that it's tough to have a top three, but it's my best shot. Right. Okay.
Okay. Right, I'll take it.
All right. Cool. So first off, strong authentication, right? And what we mean by that is you simply cannot rely on username and password alone, right? That's just bad practice nowadays. So when we say strong authentication, what we really mean is MFA or multi-factor authentication. So that means, and I think most people, or at least I hope, are familiar with that now. You know, your banks may require you to have, yes, you sign in with your username, your password, but then you also get either a text message or, you know, a prompt from an app on your phone, and you have to say, yes, that's me, right? Yeah, you let me in. This isn't just someone hasn't stolen my credentials. So that it may sound simple, but you'd be surprised how many people still don't have multi-factor authentication deployed on all of their applications or points of entry into their network, right? So that's, I would say, that's my number one. The other one I would say is strong vulnerability management, right? So we talked about threats and vulnerabilities earlier, those unintentional, you know, holes that exist. Well, vendors patch all the time, right? Patches are released on a very regular basis. However, not a lot of organizations, though we're getting better, right? We've been beating this drum a while now, patch, patch, patch. But you'd be surprised how many vulnerabilities or exploits actually occur because of delay in patching.
Interesting.
And so I would say have a very strong vulnerability management program and make sure that you identify those vulnerabilities, assess their criticality, and apply those patches immediately. Have a set schedule where you do that. It's got to be timely. You can't just put your feet up and wait to do it at your own convenience. It has to happen quickly.
And I see there are several tools available now in the industry to help with patching types of things, right? To make sure that the devices are updated, the software is updated. But I also see a challenge because there are so many tools, and the spread of devices becomes very challenging. And then how do you deal with bring your own devices to keep those things patched for cybersecurity vulnerabilities? I mean, it seems like it's an endless battle to me.
Oh, well, it is. It is an endless battle. But that's where I kind of think that, you know, the concept of zero trust comes in. You know, this is a philosophy that we've been talking about now for, well, a long time. But, you know, for those who might not be familiar with what zero trust is, in the past, you know, when we designed networks and people would come on, you know, on site or whatever, it was always like, all right, come on in, you know, no big deal. now Zero Trust is it's really a framework about how you can require, regardless of what the device is, whether it's a managed asset, right? So if it's a company provided asset or a university provided asset, whatever it is, or it's personal, you don't trust it, right? Require it to revalidate, you know, who you are, confirm that you say who you are and what you're getting access to, right? Don't just allow everything to access everything, right? It's you have to really isolate and be very fine, provide very fine-grained access to whatever application or service that you're trying to get to, and you have to validate your identity every single time that you get there. And so in the cases of, like, say, Bridgewater State University, if you bring a device on campus, one of the things that we check to see is, all right, so you're logging into our wireless network. Well, who are you? Are you affiliated with the institution or are you a guest? Well, if you're a guest, you're just getting dumped out to the internet, right? But if you're part of the institution, then one of the things that we're looking at is, okay, well, what are you signing in with? Is it a device that we recognize? Is it a personal device? Is it a university device? Is it current on all its patches? Well, so we basically go through this multi-layered approach of identifying who you are, what device that you have, and then we provide access to whatever you're trying to access. And so that's a philosophy that really has been around for a while, but more, I would say more recently, within the past 5 years or so, it's really kind of the buzzword of Zero Trust has really started to kind of show itself more in the industry. And it's really something that, you know, will continue to be ongoing, but I don't think it's a set and done. Like, you can't, I think a lot of people think you could buy Zero Trust.
Right, right.
You can't product your way out of this. It's a philosophy. It's a mindset. It's a journey. You're not really done.
So first, I want to thank you for explaining Zero Trust, because it's been really helpful for me. But secondly, I want to ask you, bringing back to things like physical security devices, how do you vet that technology when you're looking at a manufacturer, you're looking at buying devices that are going to ride on your network, whether it's for physical security or something else that's related to that? Do you guys have a process for vetting that? Does it have to be approved and tested and checked out by your team? How does that work?
So the short answer is yes, it does have to be checked out. And yes, it does have to be vetted. So like I mentioned earlier, we're fortunate enough that we have a centralized information technology division at Bridgewater State University. So we've built strong relationships with all of the different business units within the university. And one particular relationship that's very important is procurement, right? And so one thing that we really worked on with procurement is nothing technology-wise that gets purchased, I don't care if it's software, hardware, whatever device that it is, that needs to get vetted by IT, right? And so we take a look at that. Our team will take a look at that and understand the need, try to understand the risk profile, what any potential exposures might be. We may even go so far as to do vulnerability scans on the asset once it arrives, that sort of thing. And so we also have vendor policies that we go through to really make sure that we have a strong grasp on. We'll look at, for example, has the company passed a SOC 2 Type 2, like, which is a type of audit and certification report, so that, you know, whether it's a physical device or if it's a cloud hosted service or whatnot, we just want to make sure that we understand our vendors, we have an inventory of our vendors, we know how the software or the service or the device is going to be used, and then that it's gone through the proper vetting process. So
nice.
I'm not going to lie, it's not even always an easy thing. It's a challenge, but it's something that you really have to do. You got to know, fundamental thing of cybersecurity is an inventory. You got to know what's on your network. And so we've been really fortunate to establish a culture of cyber first. You know, we have a little saying that we say at Bridgewater State is protect you, protect BSU, right? Make it personal first. Right? Because it is, because the things that we're always, you know, complete your cybersecurity training, right? That's obviously an ongoing requirement for all of our faculty, librarians, and our staff. But the training that they learn is something that applies to their personal lives as well.
It's a great cultural comment, a great cultural sort of mantra. It's part of the education process, and I'm sure in your practice, but I'm really curious, one, about AI. I've seen that there are these emerging tools out there where AI can assist in cybersecurity protection. And then also the other component of that is social engineering. So as part of this educational program, as part of your own profile, what are you doing about social engineering? And what are you doing about AI? Is it being used? Or is it a bigger threat?
Well, it's a huge threat. And we're already seeing it, right? It's existing out there. With, you know, generative AI, which, you know, everyone's heard of back in, November of 2022 is when OpenAI came up with ChatGPT, which is the form of what's called generative AI, right? AI has existed for decades, right? And I think a lot of people don't realize that. But it's this really release of generative AI, which allows for that natural language. And what that's allowed, well, like every new technology, which has a lot of potential benefits and opportunities, always comes with it some potential ways to use it negatively as well. And we're already seeing that with generative AI, particularly to your point, when it comes to crafting phishing messages. Right. We used to rely on what we've been trained on for years is look for the anomalies in how the phishing message is written. Right. Is it using broken English? Are there misspellings? You know, that sort of thing. And with generative AI, you can craft a very well, clearly articulated phishing messages that is free from those errors that I just spoke about. So it just makes it a lot more difficult for people to identify and detect. And unfortunately are falling victim to it. So what can you do about it? Well, keep beating that drum of training, educating the community. We do that on a very regular basis through multiple different methods. I think everyone needs to do that. But unfortunately, fortunately too, there's also the AI is being incorporated into just about, it seems like it anyway, just about every company's portfolio, right? So every vendor is trying to incorporate AI or some flavor of generative AI into their service offerings. And cybersecurity is no exception to that. So we are already reaping the benefits of AI in helping with process very large, vast amounts of information that would otherwise take humans a very long time to do. So the technology is being incorporated into different cybersecurity tools to help mitigate that risk, but it's still always going to be, it's going to be a challenging landscape going forward. That's for sure.
It really is. And to me, it always seems like social engineering is the lowest hanging fruit, where it's the biggest opportunity that we can improve our cyber posture, but it's also the largest threat because things just keep evolving. But to wrap up, I really would like you to just jump ahead to the future here. Take your crystal ball out. And what does the field of cybersecurity look like in the next 10 years? Do you have
10 years?
Yeah. Well, I mean, give me 5 years if you can, Steve. I'll take 5 years.
Yeah, right. Well, I can tell you what I hope it looks like. How's that? I don't know if this will happen, but one can hope that we won't have the critical shortage of cyber professionals that we have now, right? Hopefully all the efforts that we're putting in here and making cybersecurity training accessible to all and the availability of it is going to help mitigate this national and global threat. So that would be one thing. And I would hope too, we talked about diversity earlier, that I would hope that we're going to be able to diversify the cyber talent pipeline going forward within the next, you know, I hope it's not, doesn't take 5 years, but 5 to 10 years for sure, we're going to have a different outlook, a different representation of people in the cyber industry than we have right now. I would say looking real big and bold, right? I think we're going to have continued challenges when it comes to cybersecurity, but particularly with the intersection of AI and quantum computing. Right. So quantum computing uses a form of basically quantum mechanics and is atom based and can basically, the long and short is, it can process huge amounts of data at speeds that we've never thought imaginable before, right? So it basically, it thousands of times faster than a traditional computer can process data. And so when you think about that, huge amounts of processing power combined with artificial intelligence is going to create a huge cyber risk globally, right? And so the ability to crack cryptography with quantum, with computers that otherwise can't really do that right now, at least in a short time period, with quantum, they'll be able to crack it very, very, very quickly. And so I think we're going to find ourselves in a situation 5 to 10 years from now, you know, where, we're going to have to be looking at cybersecurity in through a different landscape with the combination of quantum computing and AI in particular.
Well, it's a pretty interesting look into the future, Steve. And I want to thank you for ensuring that we're all going to be awake tonight, kind of scared about what that might mean for us all. And hopefully we'll use some of that technology for good and not just to get into our bank accounts. Fascinating discussion. I want to thank you for being here and being so patient and taking the time to answer all our questions, Steve. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Scott. I really appreciate the time.
I'm Scott Dunn.
I'm James Marcella. Thanks for joining us on Connect, an Axis Communications podcast.